The Economist magazine for February 7th through February 13th, 2026, continues on page 13, the leaders section. Scientific research. The evolution of invertebrates. Congress defended science against Donald Trump. Its work is not over. American scientists spent much of 2025 in shock. The Trump administration canceled thousands of grants and withheld billions of dollars from researchers. Labs were forced to close their doors as they ran out of cash. Fewer foreign researchers applied to move to America, and rising numbers of American scientists began to look abroad for jobs. Worse, Donald Trump's spending proposals for 2026 aimed to cut the budgets for America's main science funding agencies in half. This assault on science has provoked a rare reaction from otherwise supine Republicans in Congress. They have rejected $30 billion in proposed cuts and hardened the language in the spending bill to help them enforce how the administration spends the money. Lawmakers deserve credit for rediscovering the power of the purse and their spines. They ought now to stiffen these further by using congressional oversight to undo more of the damage Mr. Trump and his team are visiting on American science. The president's budget would have eviscerated research. Mr. Trump proposed cutting 40% of the money going to the National Institutes of Health, which pays for much groundbreaking academic work and conducts plenty of its own. In addition, he demanded that it slash the number of its institutes from 27 to 8. Congress was having none of this, choosing instead to preserve the agency structure and increase its budget by 1%. Legislators also maintained funding for the National Science Foundation, NASA, and the Department of Energy's Office of Science at similar levels to the previous year. They did not only safeguard the size of the budget. They also constrained the president by inserting language in the text of the spending bill that specifies how and when science dollars must be spent. In previous years, these instructions were published alongside the bill in explanatory documents, which, even though they are not legally binding, the White House tended to honor as reflecting the will of Congress. By writing these instructions into the statute itself, Congress has left less room for a notoriously norm-breaking administration to spend the money in ways that lawmakers had not intended or not to spend it at all. These actions show that lawmakers recognized how Mr. Trump's assault would blunt American scientific and technological edge, killing good science jobs and hurting local economies. Having stood up for the constituents in the budget fight, lawmakers should also protect them by exercising their power of oversight to stop the administration's war on scientific advice and expertise. In the past year, federal science agencies have been shedding staff. Mr. Trump's appointees have also terminated, suspended, or otherwise tampered with the work of some 200 expert committees that advise the government on everything from medicine to energy. See Science and Technology section. Grant panels and other bodies have been politicized and stacked with cranks. These changes are already affecting Americans. Last month, the Health Department abruptly cut the list of recommended routine immunizations from children from 13 to 7, cutting down programs that collect environmental data will mean that Americans will be less able to prepare for worsening extremities in weather. Skeleton crew. The Senate should start by summoning Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., the anti-vax health secretary, to explain why vaccine guidance was changed without adequate consultation. Both houses should step up their scrutiny of other committees and environmental monitoring, as with sparing science funding. Americans will thank them for that. The last article in the leader section comes from page 14. Revolution in Asia. The new Bangladesh is only half built. Whoever wins the coming election has a lot to do. 18 months have passed since a revolution in Bangladesh brought down the despotic Sheikh Hasina Wajid and her thuggish Awami League. On February 12th, the country of 176 million people will hold a general election, marking the return of democracy at last. It is a seminal moment, the first competitive vote in Bangladesh since 2008. For months, observers have worried that violence would break out. So far, thankfully, they have been proved wrong. The contest is largely a fight between two long-established parties, both of which were persecuted by the old regime. See Asia section. One is Jamaat El Islami, the largest and most moderate of Bangladesh's Islamist outfits. The other is the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, BNP, led by years by the late Khalida Zia, a former prime minister, and now fronted by her son, Tarku Rahman. The BNP is the favorite to win. Many are rightly disappointed that Bangladesh's upheaval has not empowered better new parties with bold new agendas. Sheikh Hasina's regime was execrable, but the politics that came before her were also grim. The Islamists, who are about to win a lot of seats, are also certainly less tolerant than they are making out. And the BNP's previous stints in power were marred by extreme corruption and worse. But Bangladesh's progress should be weighed against its wretched state 2 years ago and against well-founded fears that its caretaker government would fail to keep the peace. Meanwhile, given the long distance Bangladesh has to travel, its achievements are big and worth celebrating. Let me reread that sentence. Given the long distance Bangladesh has had to travel, Its achievements are big and worth celebrating. The election will thrust the revolution into a new and risky phase as more conventional politics resumes. Support from foreign friends may wane. Politicians tasting power for the first time in two decades may revert to the old bad ways. And Bangladesh will flourish only if it sustains its enthusiasm for reform. Whoever wins will have a lot to do. The most urgent worry is the economy. The interim government, led by Mohamed Yunus, a Nobel laureate, kept it from disaster. But big changes are needed. This year, Bangladesh will graduate from a group of least developed countries that enjoy advantages in trade and concessionary loans. It needs to make its factories more efficient. It must increase government revenue, which is 7% of the GDP, compared with 20% across Asia. And it needs to cut red tape and hammer corrupt bureaucrats who hold businesses to ransom. Relations with India matter too. Bangladeshis are right to resent how Sheikh Hasina has been backed by the government in Delhi. They are irked when Indian officials falsely paint Bangladesh as tainted by anti-Hindu rage. But the caretaker administration was too ready to needle India. The next government must reset ties. The last task is political renewal at home. In an election day referendum, Bangladeshis will be asked about constitutional reforms aiming to cut the risk of fresh tyranny. They should back them, and the next government should see them into law, though the temptation to wiggle out will be strong. The new leaders also need to rehabilitate the Awami League, banned from politics by the interim government. That will be painful. The League has not taken responsibility for the deaths of some 1,400 people as Sheikh Hasina clung to power. But the new Bangladesh has to be built on forgiveness as well as justice. Bangladeshis can be proud of their revolution, which offered encouragement to Gen Z protests in other parts of the world. This election is a welcome milestone. But the hard job of building a new Bangladesh has only just begun. The Economist magazine continues on page 17 with By Invitation. Amir Hossein Gangbakhsh, How to Topple Iran's Ayatollahs. In the wake of a popular uprising and a crackdown that has left thousands dead, the big question in Iran is how the Islamic regime should be politically confronted. This question has been only sharpened by Donald Trump's warning that time is running out for Iran to negotiate a deal on its nuclear program. American intervention in Venezuela has promoted the idea of leadership change as an alternative to the more problematic policy of regime change. The unique institutional architecture of the Islamic Republic provides the Iranian people and the West with an opportunity to combine these two strategies. Iranians cannot expect any major change in governance while the institution of the supreme leader, known as Valiat-e-Faqih, or the guardianship of Islamic jurist, exists. And the West cannot expect the regime to shed its belligerence while this institution is at the center of decision-making in Iran. It is worth recalling that in 47 years since Iran's Islamic Revolution, 9 administrations in the White House have tried all sorts of sticks and carrots to deal with the Islamic Republic. But whenever the regime has shown flexibility, it has proved to be a mere tactical retreat. Why? It's important to understand that the Islamic Republic is institutionally sui generis. It comprises 2 non-congruent subsystems whose interaction generates chronic instability and permanent disequilibrium, the state and the Valiat-e-Faqih. The functional operation of one produces dysfunction in the other. Each of the 2 subsystems pursues its own organizational logic and incentive systems across domains ranging from sovereignty and foreign policy to governance and citizens' rights. Any reform project that seeks to strengthen state institutions while preserving Valiat-e-Faqih fundamentally misunderstands the incompatibility of these logics and is doomed to fail. This incompatibility is evidenced in the political trajectories of those who attempted to act as statesmen within the Islamic Republic. All have eventually been neutralized, barred from future office. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Mohammad Khatami, and Hussein Rouhani, eliminated Ali Rafsanjani, are imprisoned Mir Hassan Mousavi and Mahdi Karoubi. Time and again, the role has proved to be structurally incompatible with the ambitions and the logic of Valiat-e-Faqih. The roots of this contradiction lie in the aftermath of the collapse of the monarchy in 1972. The dominant role of Shia clergy in the anti-monarchical movement produced a fragile compromise between 2 sources of legitimacy: popular sovereignty expressed through elections, and divine legitimacy, which in turn justified the enforcement of Islamic law. This compromise required 2 parallel hierarchies. One was a conventional inherited state bureaucracy. The other, an Islamic bureaucracy, had no historical precedent. Clerical elites resolved this tension by elevating an undisputed authority, the supreme leader, or guardian jurist, above the state itself. To impose obedience, the supreme leader had to transcend the state altogether. Revolutionary Islam, redefined as a transnational project committed to opposing American imperialism and Zionism, provided the necessary framework. The supreme leader thus emerged not merely as the head of state, but as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, endowed with global ambitions. The seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in 1979 marked a crucial moment in this transformation. The hostage crisis embedded death to America into the ideological core of the Valiant-e-Faqih. From then on, permanent confrontation with the West became a constitutive feature of the system. The strategic objective of both the Iranian people and the international community must therefore be the dismantling of the Valiant-e-Faqih, because the Islamic constitution stipulates that Valiant-e-Faqih is the supreme institution overseeing the state. Doing away with it would require a new constitution. Leadership change would mean regime change. This cannot be achieved through elite maneuvering or foreign pressure alone. It requires national reconciliation among Iranians and the initiation of a political process leading to free and fair elections, for a constitutional assembly capable of founding a democratic state. Despite the barbarous recent repression, the opposition remains more fragmented than ever. To shift the balance of power, a new type of coalition must be forged. Former adversaries need to unite under the banner "From Pahlavi to Mousavi." Reza Pahlavi, the exiled son of the late Shah, represents the prosperity of the Pahlavi era and total opposition to Valiant-e-Faqih. Meanwhile, Mir Hasan Mousavi, a long-detained opposition leader and former prime minister, has said publicly that he no longer thinks a system that gives the final say to the supreme leader is in Iran's interests. Now is the time to get behind Mr. Mousavi's recent call for a referendum to write a new constitution. The presence of Mr. Mousavi in a new coalition would reassure military and security personnel that the goal was an orderly change rather than civil war. Mr. Pahlavi's involvement would provide assurance to the international community that Iran's regional adventurism and nuclear dilemmas will not return. By bringing these two symbols of opposition together under inclusive slogans, such as protecting Iran's territorial integrity and respecting the ballot box, those seeking change could create a new national momentum to dislodge the guardians of Islamic Republic. This double act offers the best hope for a new Iran, finally released from the suffocating grip of Valiant-e-Faqih. Amir Hossein Ganjbakhsh is an Iranian dissident based in America. The briefing section begins on page 18 and goes through page 20. Briefing. Press freedom under threat. Gag today, graft tomorrow. Delhi, Kuala Lumpur, and Washington, D.C. As democracies use autocratic tools to muzzle journalism, corruption thrives. In November 2024, a canopy on a Serbian railway station collapsed, killing 16 people. The most likely cause of the shoddy workmanship was corruption. Huge protests erupted, and independent journalists reported on them. Some were then beaten by thugs while cops looked on. Half were beaten by cops. In 2025, there were at least 91 physical attacks on journalists in Serbia, according to the country's Independent Journalists Association. Assailants are seldom punished, which encourages new crimes against journalists, says Jelena Petkovic, a local specialist in media safety. Serbia has all the trappings of a democracy. It does not lock up journalists for what they write. Yet, in dozens of ways, it makes their jobs and lives difficult, unless they support the government. KRIK, capital K-R-I-K, an investigative outlet that often exposes graft in the Serbian government, has been hit with more than 30 lawsuits in the past few years, of which 18 are current, says Stephen Dojinovic, the editor. He has to spend up to 5 days a month in court. Official media accuse him of working for the CIA and for George Soros, a Jewish billionaire. Faked pictures of him with a gang boss have been circulated, as well as real, intimate photos meant to embarrass him. It has taken a huge, heavy toll, he says. Meanwhile, all the terrestrial broadcasters are state-controlled or owned by friends of the right-wing populist president, Aleksandar Vukic. So they say what he wants them to. Zoran Kusovac, a media consultant, recounts that a friend divorced her TV editor husband, partly because she was sick of Mr. Vukic's nightly calls. Around the world, media freedom is in retreat. On an index devised by Reporters Without Borders, RSF, a watchdog, the global score has regressed since 2014, from 67 out of 100, where America is today, to under 55 in 2025, as bad as Serbia's. For the first time in the history of the index, the conditions for practicing journalism are difficult or very serious in over half of the world's countries, and satisfactory in fewer than one in four, says RSF. Others found a similar trend. Data from V-Dem, a research group based in Sweden, imply that global average has deteriorated since 2004 from 0.66 on a scale of 0 to 1 to 0.49, roughly the difference between Mexico and Hindu nationalist India today. None of the news that's fit to print. The greatest decline is occurring not in dictatorships, where proper journalism has long been almost impossible, but in places that still purport to be democratic, Typically, the governments of such places do not try to snuff out criticism entirely. Rather, they skew the incentives for news gatherers so that ordinary people hear plenty of praise for the ruling party and only occasional squeaks of dissent. The aim is to keep the powerful in power and reduce scrutiny on how they abuse it. As analysis from The Economist found, strong links between media muzzling and corruption. Looking at 80 years of data from 180 countries collected by V-Dem, we found that a reduction in media freedom in a given country was a strong predictor that graft in that country would subsequently grow worse. See Chart 1. This held true even after correcting for past and current levels of corruption, change in incomes, and worldwide trends. This is more than a case of bad things coinciding. Our analysis is temporal. It tests whether a shift in one variable reliably predicts a shift in a future shift in another. In statistical lingo, this is called Granger causality, and we found plenty of it. In the absence of a probing press, it is easier for officials to embezzle unobserved or make sweetheart deals without pushback. The statistical relationship is sizable. All else being equal, a country where press freedom degenerates from the level of Canada to that of Indonesia is predicted to see a slide in corruption equivalent to Ireland becoming Latvia. With fear and favor. And there appears to be a feedback loop. A rise in corruption is also a good predictor that media will subsequently grow less free. Perhaps because when those in power have plenty to hide, they have extra cause to gag noisy hacks. If we report on corruption, our journalists are doxed, says Wayu Dayamakika, the CEO of Tempo, a weekly in Indonesia. One was sent a severed pig's head. Others have received dozens of unrequested food deliveries, a reminder that the bigwigs they report on know exactly where to find them. These feedback loops magnify the damage, meaning the full cost of bad policies is felt only gradually. Institutions have inertia. Our model implies that on average, it takes roughly 4 years after media clampdowns for just half the eventual rise in corruption to appear. A leader can muzzle the press today, but voters may not notice the subsequent surge of skullduggery until after the next election. Another dynamic is that as media freedom diminishes, elites are less likely to offer reason justifications for their policies. See Chart 2. And this, too, tends to come before an increase in corruption. That fits with the rise of populism around the world. a movement that relies more on emotion than reason. Populist leaders usually try to weaken institutional checks on their power, including the media, and this opens the door for graft and abuse. Taken together, our statistical analysis finds that populist politics, corruption, and squeezing critical media not only go together, but mutually reinforce each other. Governments that gag the press today will govern worse tomorrow. Plenty of countries are on this perilous path. A big shift we've seen in recent years is the adoption by supposedly democratic countries of many of the techniques that we have traditionally seen in authoritarian regimes, says Jody Ginsburg, the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a watchdog. These techniques usually stop short of jailing or killing reporters. Rather, they tend to fall into three main categories: rhetorical, legal, and economic. The rhetorical trick is to pretend that critical journalists pose a threat to the nation. Autocratic regimes have long done this. Now, many elected leaders do too. Mr. Vukic describes uncomplimentary coverage as pure terrorism. Argentina's president, Javier Milei, pushes the catchphrase, "We don't hate journalists enough." Supporters of India's ruling party refer to critical reporters as prostitutes. Donald Trump recently posted that it was seditious, perhaps even treasonous, for the New York Times to publish fake reports to libel and demean the President of the United States. He added, "They are true enemies of the people, and we should do something about it." The White House publishes a list of media offenders, naming the individual reporters it accuses of lying, malpractice, or left-wing lunacy. Such unprecedented rhetoric from an American president aggravates an already hostile atmosphere for reporters. Americans' trust in the news media is at an all-time low, according to Gallup. Only 8% of Republicans in America trust them to report fairly or accurately, down from 33% in 2007, the year the iPhone was introduced, ushering in the age of rage bait. Mr. Trump's demonization of journalists erodes the taboo on other politicians doing the same, says Ms. Ginsburg. The Trump textbook is being picked up by global leaders everywhere, says Thibaut Bruton, the head of RSF. Fighting talk at the top can spur digital mobs to harass reporters. Female journalists bear the brunt. A global study by UNESCO found that 75% had received online abuse and 42% endured harassment or threats of violence in person. When victims were asked who instigated the abuse, the most common answer after anonymous culprits was political actors. In nearly every democracy, free expression is enshrined in law. So it ought to be hard for governments to use criminal law as a cudgel against journalists. But they are finding workarounds. One is to use civil law. Recent years have seen a surge in Europe's in vexatious lawsuits by plutocrats intended to bankrupt pesky journalists or hobble media outlets. A report in 2023 counted more than 800, adding that this only scratched the surface of the problem. Mr. Trump has embraced the tactic, suing ABC, the BBC, CNN, the New York Times, and others, sometimes demanding billions of dollars in damages. Another wheeze is to hit media companies with laws that are unrelated to journalism. In September, Turkey's government seized control of CAN Holding, a conglomerate that includes television stations, accusing it of tax evasion, and money laundering. In Tanzania, where President Samia Suluhu Hassan took over in 2021, promising liberal reforms, journalists have been arrested for treason, while covering a blatantly rigged election in October. By accusing journalists of common crimes, governments can spread the idea that they are untrustworthy. They can also intimidate others into self-censorship. The bit that's always difficult to measure is the stories that don't get written or the questions that don't get asked because people are fearful, says Ms. Ginsburg. Digital technology has changed what it means to be a journalist, allowing anyone with a phone to disseminate shocking footage to a potentially global audience. Nasty regimes correctly see it as a threat and have pushed back with broadly worded internet laws that can be weaponized against critics. Several ban the dissemination of fake news, which in some places means any statement that the government denies. A new law in Zambia criminalizes the unauthorized disclosure of critical information, defined as anything that relates to public safety, public health, economic stability, or national security. An index by Freedom House, an American think tank, finds that internet freedom has declined worldwide for 15 straight years. This is not just a case of autocrats turning off the internet during protests, as Iran in January, or elections, as in Uganda in the same month. In the past year, half of the 18 countries previously labeled digitally free out of 72 judged grew less so. Globally, the most consistent deterioration in the past 15 years was a measure of whether online sources of information are manipulated by the government or other powerful actors. Many use AI to create fake pro-government stories on fake sites that look like the familiar news outlet. The final category of coercion, economic, is especially powerful because governments have lots of money and media firms typically do not. In 160 out of 180 countries surveyed by RSF, news outlets can achieve financial stability with difficulty or not at all. In Indonesia, the quality of journalism has gone downhill in the past 5 or 6 years, mostly because of financial pressure, says Mr. Diamatmika of Tempo. Government advertising goes to fawning outlets. Big private advertisers shun critical media for fear of upsetting politicians. They don't see Tempo as a safe brand because we do investigate journalism, investigative journalism. When donors of NGOs support independent media, governments pass laws against foreign agents to restrict them, a trick mastered by Vladimir Putin. Another ruse is to get friendly tycoons to buy and tame critical media outlets. With several of these press-gagging techniques are combined, the effect can be overwhelming. In India, the world's largest democracy, journalists are in theory free to report what they like. But those who seek to expose abuses by the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party face a hailstorm of discouragements. Abhimanyu Sekri, the boss of News Laundry, a digital news in Delhi, says he has received official notices that he or his firm is suspected of tax evasion about 80 times in the past 4 years. Pro-government media firms sue News Laundry for defamation and copyright infringement when it criticizes their bias. Tax officials raid its offices. Police pop in to question Mr. Sakri, one time for 6 hours, another for 13. Mr. Sakri is hard to bully. He says he can keep doing his job because there's nothing dodgy in his life. He has no wife or children to worry about. He is a Hindu, and he comes from a privileged background, so he knows lawyers who will represent him pro bono. Nonetheless, defending himself is taxing. The most journalists are far more vulnerable to pressure than he is. Those most at risk are not the high-profile ones in Delhi, says Mr. Sakri. They are the ones uncovering shady activities of some local god man in a small village. Some god men may be vengeful. Jajendra Singh, who wrote about alleged links between a politician in Uttar Pradesh and the Sand Mafia, who steal truckloads of sand from public land and sell it to cement firms, died of burn injuries after a visit from police. The police said it was suicide. Independent journalism survives in India in online outlets such as The Wire and The Caravan, and on social media and YouTube. Every reporter faces a choice between a life of penny-pinching and peril, telling the truth, or one of financial and physical security, praising the government. Nearly everyone interviewed for this article noted the change in attitude to press freedom in the White House. America's domestic media ecosystem is a sophisticated and pluralistic enough to cope but American policy also affects countries whose journalism is more precarious. Orkhan Mamad, the editor of Maidan TV, an independent outlet from Azerbaijan, a corrupt petrostate in the Caucasus, says that President Ilham Aliyev used to release political prisoners because of pressure from America. But this year, the pressure has ceased, Mr. Mamad laments. Mr. Trump's family has business ties with Azerbaijani elite, and Mr. Aliyev has shrewdly endorsed him for a new Nobel Peace Prize. Democracy dies in darkness. Once Trump came back to power in 2025, Aliyev shut down everything. Around 100 journalists fled or in jail. We realized we couldn't work with anyone inside the country anymore. It was too dangerous for them. Mr. Aliyev's tactics are horrible. He says every time someone is arrested, they have to hand over their phone and computer. The government then will release personal photos found on them. America, and them is in brackets. America used to fund hundreds of independent media groups in countries with shaky civil liberties. Mr. Trump froze the funding, hobbling Maidan, among many other outlets. We have to figure out how to pay for our colleagues' legal fees, food, basic necessities inside jail, Mr. Mamad says. In August, a man Maidan hired to deliver supplies to jail journalists was arrested for smuggling money. Life has grown so tough for independent journalists in some countries that many, like Mr. Mamad, work from abroad. At a conference of such exiles in Kuala Lumpur, the mood was grim. Those attending fretted about the difficulty of reporting remotely. Information is hard to gather. Phones may not be secure. Since the Pegasus spyware scandal in 2021, when many reporters' devices were revealed to be bugged with Israeli software, it has been tough to persuade whistleblowers anywhere to talk to journalists. One source told me, "I now know why my wife lost her government job," recalls Nelson Rauda, a journalist from El Salvador whose phone was hacked. Even exile is not always safe. Several regimes silence critics from afar. Iran hired an assassin in New York to kill Massad Alijad, an Iranian journalist who championed women's rights. Belarus hijacked a passenger plane to capture Raman Patrovich, a dissident editor in 2021. Since then, Mr. Mamad says all exiled journalists worry about their flights being diverted. As for Mr. Petrovich, after 2 years in custody, he now praises the corrupt dictatorship that kidnapped him. Letters, page 16. Excuse me. AI and the car industry. Your analogy between the car industry and the artificial intelligence industry was well chosen. Europe's DeepSeek moment, January 24th. Both car making and AI development are capital intensive, demanding substantial investments to launch a serious contender. Yet in both cases, the underlying principles are widely known and openly documented. That is why DeepSeek could produce a competitive model so quickly, and why a European firm like Mistral can design systems that rival those of the American giants. Just as no single car maker dominates global markets, no AI provider is likely to achieve lasting worldwide supremacy. Different cars suit different drivers. Different models will suit different users. AI, like the automobile, will be shaped less by monopoly than by shifting competition of strengths, weaknesses, and trade-offs. That is if policymakers resist the temptation to pick winners in advance. Moritz Gross-Wenthrop, university professor, faculty of computer science, University of Vienna. Place item in bag. I read Bartleby's parable of the supermarket self-checkout January 17. Whenever I wait in the can't manage checkout without help line at my nearest store, I watch the supervisor of the bank of self-checkout machines gaze wistfully at me and the other boomers he is unable to tempt away from human cashiers. I try hiding behind the nearest kiosk to spare his feelings, but I am tall and white-haired, so it's of no use. Easily befuddled at my age, I have to protect my fragile hold on sanity. That means avoiding things like automated voices that shout at me to put my items in the bag when they are already in it. Margaret McGurr, Greenwich, Connecticut. Supermarket tech is such a big capital expenditure with such expected payback. What is never known until tech is operational in stores is just how much shrinkage that is from shoppers failing to pay for goods then results. Someone I knew, a former banker, would compare different retailers' till systems by how much he could shoplift. Richard Worsley, Chichester.